Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an author, journalist and former Labour politician who served in the Blair government, though by that time he'd already reported from wars in Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia. His acclaimed trilogy of political diaries covers the rise and fall of New Labour from start to finish, and his 1982 novel, A Very British Coup, has been adapted into a BAFTA and Emmy award-winning television drama. In 91, he was absolutely key in overturning the conviction of the wrongly accused Birmingham Six. He's recently published a memoir, Hinterland. Chris Mullen, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Hinterland, why that name and what does it mean to you?
Young people occasionally approach me, ambitious young people who want to go into politics, and ask me for my advice. And my advice is always the same, although it may be wrong in career terms. Go away and do something useful first, and then you might be some use if and when you get elected to Parliament. The correct advice, as I'm sure you realise, is go to Oxford, study PPE, come out and get a job either in a political think tank or an MP's office. Use the contacts that you garner during that time to lever yourself into a safe seat, and with any luck, you'll be on the front bench by the age of 30.
So your point is you need to have a hinterland, really, before you take up any meaningful public position.
In my view, yes. Before you start representing people, you need to have done something. It may be my prejudice, actually, rather than reality, but there do seem to me to be quite a lot of members of Parliament these days who didn't actually do very much, except perhaps politics, before they got into Parliament. Tony Blair had a very low opinion of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and so he scouted the highways and byways to lever in bright, upwardly mobile young people in his own image and likeness. And so you had this sort of first and second class carriage developing in the House of Commons tea room. They were all very bright, very personable, but most of them, not all, had never knocked on a door on behalf of anybody but themselves. And so they were kind of parachuted in. And some of them proved to be quite good ministers, but I personally began to react against the cult of youth that seemed to be developing. Of course, with the election of Jeremy Corbyn, it's gone in entirely the opposite direction now, so I'm out of date.
You, of course, do have a vast hinterland, and that's really what I'd like to look at, just to look back at your life so far and what's brought you to this point, the person that I keep describing to my colleagues as our finest prime minister that we never had.
There's lots of them about.
Chris, tell us about your early years.
Well, I was brought up in a middle-class family in Chelmsford in Essex. I studied law at university, but since I was spending more time editing the student newspaper than I was studying law, it seemed logical to become a journalist. I got a place on the Daily Mirror's training scheme for young journalists. You did 2 years on half a dozen local newspapers they owned in Devon and Cornwall. And then, if you were lucky, you got an offer of a job on one of their national titles.
While you were still on that scheme, though, didn't you land an enormous scoop?
Well, I did several things that actually upset some of my contemporaries and certainly my superiors. One, I became the Labour candidate in North Devon against Jeremy Thorpe. That didn't really upset them because the managing director was also a Labour candidate somewhere, so they couldn't really argue against that, and they didn't. I managed to get an interview with the Prime Minister, yes, Harold Wilson, for a magazine called Student, which was then run by a very definitely upwardly mobile entrepreneur called Richard Branson. And the other thing I did was I managed to wangle my way on a trip to China somewhat before China opened up, or as it was beginning to open up, before the Nixon visit, certainly. And so I had 2 good years down in Devon.
And that China trip, of course, sparked off this huge love of travel and a lot of journeying throughout that region.
It was one of the formative experiences of my life, I think. The only organisation getting visas to China from the UK at that time was something called the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding. And they had a group of young people going. And since I was young, I managed to wangle my way on to the end of that. Mainly they were students, in many cases students of Chinese at Oxford and Cambridge. And we went to Moscow's Yaroslav station and we got the train across Siberia and Mongolia. Mongolia was a closed country at that time too, to China. And then we spent 5 wonderful weeks going round China, which was just emerging from the Cultural Revolution at that time. And then we came back the same way on the train. Great experience, 8 weeks altogether.
Your whole career as an investigative journalist has been spent in a lot of that part of the world, examining stories in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in Tibet.
Well, I was on the Daily Mirror train scheme, as I say, at the time, and I got an offer of a job on the Sunday Mirror, where I had my first lesson in expenses fraud, incidentally. We can come to that in a minute, if you like.
I'd love to hear. Tell us.
Well, when I'd been there a few weeks, I was only an apprentice at the time. At the end of my first week, I handed in my pathetic little expenses to the man who was supposed to vouch for their accuracy. And he refused to endorse them on the grounds that they were so low they'd embarrass everybody else in the office. So I screwed it up and threw them away. And an older hand took pity on me. And this being 1970, a time when the national average wage was 21 quid. And he showed me by one means or another how to get it up to about £70, which appeared to be the average in the office. And when he wasn't looking, I threw that away too. But 30 years later, perhaps more than 30 years later, during the great parliamentary expenses meltdown, yes, nearly 40 years later, I had a call from a journalist on the Sunday Mirror. And he was doing a story about MPs' expenses. And the theme of his story was clearly going to be they're all at it, which they weren't, incidentally, but that's another story. So I said to him, well, I don't know if he ever worked in one place where they were all at it. And that was the Sunday Mirror in 1970. He went very quiet and I never heard from him again.
Oh, dear. Working on the Mirror, as you were saying, a great opportunity to travel and to uncover some really, really important stories.
That wasn't working on the Mirror. I got an offer of a job on the Sunday Mirror and I thought it wasn't for me. And so I paid £81 for a one-way ticket to the Far East and sort of worked my way backwards. I reasoned that no one was ever likely to pay to send me to those interesting places, but that if I got myself out there, I might just scrape a living by working backwards. And that's more or less what happened. I went to Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, much later, 1980, to Tibet. Again, I think that was the first British tour of Tibet.
And all of this time, your politics career, what was happening in that?
Not an enormous amount. North Devon, where Jeremy Thorpe was the MP, wasn't much prospect for Labour there. So I collected my 5,500 votes and went on my way. I fought Norman Lamont in Kingston-on-Thames, another at that time very safe Tory seat, in 1974, February 74. And then I decided that if I was serious about getting into Parliament, I decided, though, that I'd only go for safe seats thereafter on the grounds that I didn't wish to find myself out of work in my 40s. And so I only put in for safe seats, and it was quite a long time. I'd almost given up, in fact, when I was selected for Sunderland South. And so in 1987, I was elected for Sunderland South, and I was there for 23 years.
Let's just go back a little bit, because by that time you were about to get married to your wife, who you'd met in Vietnam.
That's right, yes. When my career as a freelance journalist began to dry up in the early 80s, I had a friend who ran a travel agency down in Bristol, which got the first British tours to post-war Vietnam, and also actually the first one to Tibet. And because I knew a bit about both those places, they asked me to lead the tours. And in the case of Vietnam, my wife was the Vietnamese courier, so that's how we met. And we've been together ever since.
Your time in politics, particularly the first couple of years, really weren't easy at all.
Well, no, because I, as you know, in the 80s, a civil war rent the Labour Party, as happens from time to time. And I was on, I put this in inverted commas, the wrong side, certainly the losing side of it. I was a very good friend of Tony Benn. And in the great struggle in 1981, it was a battle actually over a very small office, the deputy leadership, but it was a cathartic moment. And so I wasn't popular with the Labour establishment, having been seen as an acolyte of Tony Benn and indeed a good friend of Tony Benn. And so it was made very clear to me from the outset that I could expect no preferment. I wasn't particularly looking for any, but I've just come from the House of Commons, actually. I just spent half an hour with Neil Kinnock, and we get on very well now. We're just back to where we were in the 70s. It looked very nice. But he wasn't very keen on me. And indeed, because I edited a little newspaper called Tribune, the one that George Orwell was once the literary editor of, and we gave him a very hard time in the early years of his leadership. And so he came up to Sunderland after I was selected, but before I was elected. And he was... Actually, he was in Middlesbrough in the Dragonora Hotel. And thinking he was among safe company, he began to make his mouth go. And he said, what's gone wrong in Sunderland? He said, first they got a MP, and this is a reference to my estimable former colleague, Mr. Bob Clay, who's, I quote, a boil on the arse of the Labour Party, and now they've gone and selected a certifiable lunatic. So, I wasn't expecting to be carried shoulder high into the tea room, and I was not disappointed.
Oh dear. But things improved, and indeed you went on to great things under Tony Blair.
Great is a slight exaggeration, but eventually, after being blackballed a number of times, onto the Home Affairs Select Committee. And in due course, I became chairman of that. And the Select Committee is one of the strong parts of Parliament. People often say, oh, Parliament's in decline. But actually, that's the one part that's really strengthened. That's the reason why we've ever seen Mr. Murdoch in public having to account for his the actions of his corporation, or indeed the bankers, or the dreadful Sir Philip Green, because they've been interviewed by Select Committees with the television cameras turned on. So I was on the Select Committee for a long time. And then Tony Blair, he rang up one day and asked if I'd like to be the lowest form of life in the vast Department of Environment, Transport and the Regions. And actually my heart sank, because being chairman of the Select Committee was actually a better job than that. So I said no, actually, initially. He rang back and he said, now come off it, Chris. It's only for a few months and then I'll find you something more up your street in the Foreign Office or the Home Office. So I'm afraid I fell for that. And I spent 18 inglorious months as the lowest form of life in this enormous department, where life was a cascade of all the many things that your superiors, and there were a lot of superiors, didn't wish to do. So invitations that had started out with the Secretary of State would be passed down through the hierarchy till they arrived, often at very short notice, in the in tray of the humble parliamentary Under Secretary of State. And one day, I hadn't been there more than a few days, I think, one of these invitations turned up, and it came from Nick Rainsford, the Housing Minister's office. And it still had his private secretary's note appended to it. And it said, this is of very low importance. I suggest we pass it to Mr. Mullin, as though I needed any reminding of my place in the pecking order. So I wrote on it in large letters, no. And as I anticipated, within minutes, someone was in my office explaining to me why it was really of the highest importance.
And I suppose that meant sort of turning up and giving speeches which you probably hadn't written and knew very little about.
Oh, which I certainly hadn't written. And every day it was a white-knuckle ride, because you were asked to be pronounced in front of often very well-informed audiences of experts on subjects which I knew very little about, certainly initially, and didn't have much to do with. Sometimes I was just standing in for other people. It was a kind of humiliating experience, because up to that time, what little bit of credibility I had accumulated in the outside world rested on only opening my mouth on things that I knew about. And now I was required to opine on subjects about which I knew absolutely nothing. And the terrifying moment would come, after you read out one of these speeches, when the chairman would say, and the minister has time to answer a few questions. And that was very terrifying.
It wasn't a position, as you say, that you stayed in for a huge amount of time, and you went on to bigger and greater things, including being the Minister for Africa, which is, of course, when I first came across you.
I had two wonderful years in the Foreign Office, yes. After the first couple of years as a minister, I also did a stint in the International Development Department, which I enjoyed. It's a great department, that. And then I decided to return to the backbenches and actually became chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee for a second time. And then after another 2 years, Prime Minister asked me to go to the Foreign Office and be the Africa Minister, which was wonderful. I had a marvellous time for 2 years. And I felt I was doing something, albeit I was just a small-ish cog in a big wheel, but I thought I was doing something useful. And there was a spring in my step when I went to work every morning, yes.
And why did that end?
Prime Ministers like throwing all the pieces into the air and seeing where they land from time to time. Blair in particular did. Successive governments, it happened under John Major too, got into the habit of annual reshuffles. And the most expendable people were the junior ministers. So although I probably lasted longer than anybody else, 2 years as Africa minister, there were in my time, I was the sixth, there were nine in our 13 years in office. And it's happening again now. I met the current incumbent the other day and I said, what number are you? I think he said he was six, and they've only been in office 7 years. And frankly, it doesn't do us any good abroad because, as you know, African leaders tend to stay too long, if anything. And you are operating at head of state level, although you're a relatively junior member of the government, and they do expect to see the same face twice. And they rarely do. It's terribly embarrassing.
Chris, one of the defining points in your career, I think, is what you did for the Birmingham Six. People may not remember who they were or why they were arrested, or indeed why and how they were finally released, which was largely down to you.
I was a journalist in the 70s, and a friend of mine, a journalist called Peter Chippendale, had attended the trial of the people charged with the Birmingham pub bombings, which at that time were the biggest murder in British history, in which 21 people had died and about 200 were seriously injured. He also attended the trial of the Guildford Four, so-called, who were charged with bombing pubs in Woolwich and Guildford. And he remarked to me at the time, this is 1975, that he thought they got the wrong people in both cases, and he came to that conclusion from his attendance at court and chatting to one or two of the relatives and so forth. And so I took an interest from that time onwards, but I didn't have the resources to do anything about it. And then eventually I persuaded the publisher to commission a book, but even that didn't provide me with the resources I needed. And finally I persuaded a good friend of mine, Ray Fitzwalter, who was the editor of World in Action and one of the premier documentary series, to take me on for a few months to examine the Birmingham Six case and see if we could come up with any new evidence. And, well, to cut a long story short, we demolished the case against them. But that didn't prove they didn't do it. That just proved the case against them was weak, which, of course, it was. To prove that they hadn't done it, you had, in my view, to find the people who did do it and persuade them to own up in such detail as it wasn't possible to pretend that the right people were in jail. So that's what I did. I set out, actually, on my own, because Granada weren't at that time interested in that angle, to track down those who made and who planted the bombs in Birmingham, and I did. We made a drama documentary on Granada Television at prime time, in which I was played by John Hurt. And yes, there came a day in March 1991, when they were catapulted out of the front door of the Old Bailey with crowds lining the streets and police helicopters overhead and a wall of cameras. The pictures went round the world. Even my wife's relatives in Vietnam saw them. And it led to a royal commission and to a shake-up of the criminal justice system. So it was a big day, really. It was the humbling of one of the world's most arrogant legal systems.
Mm. It wasn't the first time, of course, that you'd been involved with television, because your book, A Very British Coup, which did incredibly well, also got made not once but twice into a TV programme.
Yes, I wrote a novel in the early 1980s called A Very British Coup, which is still in print to this day. Indeed, there's another edition coming out shortly. And it was based on the possibility, which was quite realistic at the time, that a left-wing government led by someone like Tony Benn would come to power and that the establishment would behave badly were that to be the case. And indeed, there were already rumblings from the army and the security services and so forth. And so a friend of mine said, I was coming home on the train from Blackpool, actually, from a Labour Party conference, and there were three colleagues with me, all of whom subsequently became Labour MPs, and we were discussing what would happen if there was a Benn-led government. And one of my colleagues said, oh, that would make a good idea for a novel. And another one said, well, by the swimming pool in Greece the previous summer, he'd tapped out four chapters of exactly such a novel. And another one said, well, he'd just circulated to publishers outline for a novel on the... So I thought, blimey, I'd better get on with this. So I did. And the reason it endured was because a few of the things that are in the novel came to pass. For example, I had a MI5 agent on the council of CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and that turned out a few years later to be a chap called Harry Newton, who'd been there for years. I had someone in the BBC vetting the personnel files of people whose careers were not to progress. And that turned out in 1986, 5 years after the novel was published, to be Brigadier Ronnie Stoneham, who would occupy stamping upturned Christmas trees on the personnel files of the ideologically unsound in room 101 in Broadcasting House. And then, of course, Spycatcher by Peter Wright, the former MI5 man, in which he admitted to bugging and burgling his way across London, as he put it. All added grist to the mill, so that an excellent TV series was made of it. Yes, it won BAFTAs and it won an Emmy in America. It did very well in America. And then, just after I retired from Parliament in 2010, somebody bought the rights again, and they made another... Actually, I think I was very lucky, because the second film was good, but it bore very little relation to the book. It just said, inspired by A Very British Coup. at the end. So I think they probably could have got away with it without buying the rights. But anyway,
there are so many wonderful stories like that in your book, Hinterland, which is your memoir, really. And it follows on from your diaries and from a very British coup. I mean, one can read that you've been very, very prolific, and so many lovely stories that I would urge listeners to dip into.
Yes,
to see. One of them I just have to mention is about Les Landai.
Well, you're taking me back now to my days as the lowest form of life in the Department of Environment, Transport and the Regions. The permanent secretary came to see me after I'd been there a few days, and I was very down. And he said, well, now look, and I had already worked this out for myself. He said, you're not going to be here very long, and you're not going to have much influence, frankly. So why don't you just pick two or three issues where you think you can make a difference and focus on them and leave the rest to the big guys? So, yeah, I thought that sounds a sound strategy. So one of the ones on which I alighted was Les Landai trees, which were a form of warfare in the suburbs because they're very fast growing. And so if you've fallen out with your neighbour, you plant a row of Les Landai trees in the back garden, and very soon, because they grow at the rate of about 4 feet a year, you've blacked out his garden and perhaps his conservatory and his house too. So we used to get lots and lots of letters about this. To solve the problem, only required a minor amendment to the planning law. So I thought, well, if we can't sort this out, we might as well all go home. So Michael Mitru and I commissioned research, and it concluded that only amending the law would do. There was no other way around it. And then word came from Downing Street that the Prime Minister, no less, did not want any legislation on this subject. I said, the Prime Minister? He can't have spent more than 5 seconds on this matter. And the messenger from Downing Street sort of looked a bit sheepish and said, well, that was probably so. Turned out that a lady called Angie Hunter, very influential in Blair's office, she was the sort of gatekeeper, had seen Rory Bremner on television the previous Sunday, and he was doing a little skit about New Labour, and Labour governments always get accused of wanting to bring in the nanny state. And he'd one line in this skit. But then, do you know, they're even planning to change the law to control the size of high hedges. And so she'd gone in and reported this to Blair the next morning, and word had come from number 10 that God knows what they were afraid of. They were terrified of being called the nanny state, of course. But actually, we even had the Daily Mail and the Telegraph on our side on this. It was a no-brainer. Anyway, so then Michael Mitru and I consulted all those interests again and came, of course, to exactly the same conclusion. However, it was decided to circulate a leaflet advising people that it wasn't a good idea to plant Les Landai in suburban gardens. So there came a day, and it's pure yes, Minister, this, there came a day when the officials brought up the draft of this leaflet, and Michael Mitchell and I were sitting in his office, and Michael read through it and said, where exactly does it say that it's not a good idea to plant Les Landai in suburban gardens? Ah, Minister, it doesn't quite put it as boldly as that. In fact, said one of the others, it could be taken to mean exactly the opposite. And so we scrapped that anyway. Took 4 years, I think, to sort out. Long after I'd gone, eventually we smuggled through an amendment to the Antisocial Behaviour Bill. And I think it's sorted out now. I hope it is.
Chris, your time in Parliament is very amusingly told through this book, and indeed your time in journalism too. We started near the beginning talking about the civil war in Labour back in the 70s. And I wonder, now that we look at the Labour Party today, what you think the future for the party is and what the template really is for a healthy democracy.
Labour is prone to civil wars. It happened in the 50s. It happened again in the 70s. And I suppose it happened again after the election of Jeremy Corbyn. That seems to calm down a bit for the moment, partly because of the better than expected showing in the general election. Well, frankly, we've got a number of open goals to kick at. Her Majesty's opposition does have. The Tories have got us into an extraordinary mess, first by holding that ridiculous referendum, merely to sort out a little internal dispute in the Conservative Party, not really because it was in the national interest. And then by holding a wholly unnecessary election 2 or 3 years before they needed to, indeed said they would, with the result they've rendered the country virtually ungovernable, and we're destined to spend the next 5 years, or perhaps 10 years, arguing about Brexit. And I foresee that there's a danger that there'll be a long, steady decline. I don't think there'll be some apocalyptic disaster. I just think there'll be a long, steady decline into insularity and irrelevance if we're not careful.
Chris, it's a slightly depressing picture. Could it have been other?
Yes, he could not have held that referendum. Actually, membership of the EC was not controversial in this country until just about the time. It was controversial in the Tory party, it always has been. But the Tory party is a relatively small number of people, about 200,000 at the most. But there was no real pressure outside for David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the day, to hold a referendum. And I don't think it occurred to him for a minute, A, that he'd lose, and B, actually, it didn't occur to him that he'd have to hold the referendum. He stuck it into the 215 manifesto. And he thought that there'd be another coalition and that Lib Dems would be in the government again and they'd stop him. He wouldn't be allowed to go ahead with it. But he would have satisfied his right wing and the Tory party. That, I think, was his strategy. But by God, it backfired. Very clever man, David Cameron, and actually a fairly decent man. But these eaten-educated toffs can go badly wrong.
Do you think we'll ever see a country governed by Jeremy Corbyn?
I don't know. It must be a 30% chance. Whether governed is too strong a word, possibly these days, but there is a 30% chance to become Prime Minister, I would say. It's a remarkable turn of events, and I've no idea how it will work out. But yes, it is a possibility.
Chris, thank you so much for coming in to speak to me. For so much more, I urge you to have a look, not only at Hinterland, but at Chris's other works, which give an insightful, a hilarious, and above all, a picture of a man that is just entirely decent. Hinterland is published by Profile Books. Thanks very much to Sarah Miles, to Daphne Karnitsis and to George McDonough. I'm Georgina Godwin. You've been listening to Meet the Writers.